Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and this is Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio. With me, as always, is Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, how are you, Phil?
Well, I'm just great. Actually, I got to tell you the truth. I'm a little torn tonight. I'm in three places at once. Is the problem? My body is in Chicago. My voice is here on Fast Forward Radio, but my heart is at 20th and Blake Street in Denver at Coors Field, where the Colorado Rockies are playing the third game in the National League Championship Series against the Arizona Diamondbacks. And I can give you an update for those listening live. It is now the bottom of the seventh, and Colorado is up 4-1 over the Diamondbacks. For anyone who tunes into our show for sports.
Yeah, it may be the first time we've mentioned sports at all, but yeah, that's awesome. And well, you know, I'm a little bummed since we're going to talk sports, it's going to become a sports talk show, I guess.
Yeah, we can go in that direction. We've tried everything else.
Briefly.
Let's do that.
Yeah, you know, I'm a little bummed. My LSU Tigers, they got beat yesterday, and it was not a game that anyone was really expecting them to lose. You got to hand it to Kentucky. They played with all their heart. They didn't leave anything. They put it all out there, and won in the third overtime yesterday. And it was a great game, no doubt. It was a good game. I just love good games though when my team wins.
Yeah, probably more exciting for a Kentucky fan than an LSU
fan in
the end. although most exciting of all for the gamblers who took the long shot, I suppose.
I guess so. That should pay off pretty big for them because it was a long shot. I noticed at the end of the game they set the goalposts down as the fans were rushing the field. They went ahead and took them down, you know, in advance of them pulling them down.
They knew those goalposts were coming down.
No? They're coming down. We might as well put them down safely.
That goes to show you. You see, some outcomes are very predictable. Some outcomes not terribly predictable at all. You can get towards the end of that game and you can say, ah, the fans are going to yank down the goalposts, and you know for sure that's going to happen. But you can go into this game, and I had mentioned gamblers. I wonder what the point spread on that game was, right? I wonder what the odds that Vegas was giving for Kentucky to win that game yesterday. Probably pretty slight, I would guess.
Yeah. Just going into it, I expected that Kentucky would play hard. And what I kind of thought would happen would be that they would play hard and they'd put up a great fight the first half but would just be worn out. And the depth of LSU's talent would just overwhelm them in the second half. That just didn't happen, though. I mean, LSU made some errors. That's true, but it was mostly just Kentucky playing out of their mind good against the number one team in the country and the winning. And that's awesome. So, for them, it was what a wonderful win for them. But what an upset for my team.
Yeah, well, and it's very similar, I guess, to what the Rockies have been doing over the last month or so when when I was in San Francisco for the Singularity Summit, I was catching sports talk on the radio driving back from there, and it was a talk show talking about the Giants, and the Giants were out of it. The Dodgers were still in it, and they were talking about how the teams that were still in it were really in that division were the Diamondbacks, obviously the Padres and the Dodgers. Colorado wasn't even mentioned. You know, they were just about even with the Dodgers at that point, and they were getting ready at that point to sweep them four games, and then play them at home and sweep them three more games, and actually push them completely out of the picture. But it's that same kind of thing, only spread out over time, as you have the luxury of doing with baseball, because you have so many more games. where the Rockies have actually won the last 19. Yeah, they've won 19 of their last 20 games, and if they win tonight, it'll be 20 out of 21 games, which is just outrageous. You know, I mean, that's a great streak for any baseball team to have. But I was listening to the ESPN guy earlier today saying actually that's the best run any team has ever had going into postseason. That they've like set a new record for a number of wins, and you know whether they're the best team of all time obviously seems like a pretty shaky proposition to be making, but they've hit this unbelievable run of playing really good defense. And I mean, there's a lot of factors involved. They got some great hitters and they got a lot of energy on the team, young guys on the team, but just making all those things come together and just playing to the hilt, and suddenly what everyone was predicting would happen is not what happened. And you end up with this very unexpected set of outcomes, a very unexpected future, if you will, to tie this back into what our show is about, than what people were looking for.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I guess it just goes to show you it's just hard to predict anything.
That's right.
I mean, and of course, the further out you go in the future, I mean, I can predict with reasonable certainty that the weather's going to be great tomorrow because the weather was great today, you know. And you know, and that's a pretty good predictor, you know. We know
well until it goes wrong, right? Because
yeah, until it
sometimes
goes wrong.
Really terrible weather comes after good weather.
Yeah, after a great day. But,
right, exactly.
But the farther you get out in the future, the harder it is to predict, and that goes for anything. And so, I mean, that's basically what our Fast Forward Radio show is us, you know, making wild guesses sometimes at what we think the future may be. And you know, sometimes we have a really good basis for it. Well, we always try to have a good basis for it, right, Phil? I mean, you know,
well, sure.
It's funny, even when we have a great, you know, basis for believing what we think we know about the future. It's funny how you can sometimes go wrong with that, and futurists have always got it wrong. Seems like often they're not optimistic enough, and sometimes they don't perceive problems that
they think that things are going to be important because they're important now. I mean, actually, it's kind of the fallacy of the weather's good today, so it'll be good tomorrow. They tend to think that which is a big deal today will also be a big deal 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now. And in fact, something else is just about to emerge, and it's going to be the big deal. And often we don't know what that coming thing is. But the role of the futurist should be to try to get some bead on what those coming things are going to be. Actually, we had a great comment.
Hey, Phil, I hate to interrupt, but I want to tell you we got a caller.
Oh,
You know, hey, we might as well go to the phones, huh?
Well, absolutely.
Okay.
Bring them on.
All right.
Just as long as it's not an Arizona fan, I don't know how that's going to go.
Well, yeah, they might not be so happy with you right at this moment, but let me bring them on, okay?
All right.
Hello, caller. You're on Fast Forward Radio.
Hello, this is Carl Hollowell.
I just finally
connected. I guess this is the first one I've actually heard live.
Well, welcome to the program, Carl. It's nice to hear your voice. We've been reading your comments for years, and what's interesting is I was just about to make reference to a comment that you wrote. And now that you're on the line and have identified yourself, I can talk about it by name. Actually,
for the benefit of our listeners who may not be readers of The Speculist, Carl has been a longtime commenter at our blog, The Speculist. So, anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Phil.
Absolutely. Writes some of the best commentary that you'll find anywhere in the blogosphere, actually. Right in the comments section of our blog. So, another reason
right.
to read. But I'm sorry. Before I go off on that, Carl, maybe you had a question or something you wanted to say when you called in, so I should...
Well, right now I'm just I'll just listening. But,
okay, fair enough. Because I'm gonna put it right back on you anyhow, because we had mentioned that we were going to talk about the unpredictability of the future, and Carl,
right.
you had written a comment about a book about the fall of the USSR. Actually, it was not about the fall of the USSR. It was about military objectives in Soviet foreign policy that, as you point out, failed to predict the fall of the USSR. So I think this is the kind of thing that Stephen and I were just talking about. You can you can project into the future, and this guy was looking. The author of this book was obviously looking very close in great detail at a lot of different factors going on within the Soviet Union, but to ask the question of, well, whether this will this whole system continue to exist 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now. Or in fact, in his case, I guess he wrote this about, what, 30 years back? Or no, I guess
well,
about
he actually wrote that in 85, or as I understand, that was the cutoff date.
Okay.
And it actually was published in 87.
Okay. So.
Right about the time.
Right, yeah, that is.
So that's
well,
kind of
you know,
sad.
On a more serious note, I mean, there were so many people who didn't foresee, I mean, well, pretty much who did foresee September the 11th. That was called later a failure of the imagination,
right?
Of the intelligence community, we just didn't even see this on the radar screen. Although, you know, I mean, the threat was obviously there,
right?
But the level of devastation and using airplanes to do it, that just wasn't even on the radar screen apparently.
That's a really good point. Although I want to go back, I thought your question was going to be who did see the fall of the Soviet Union, and I was going to give an answer to that. Other than Ronald Reagan, who apparently had always had that in mind for that to happen, Peter Schwartz and the Global Business Network. I almost want to say Global Futures Network, the group I'm affiliated with now, but the Global Business Network. Before they were the Global Business Network, at the time he was still just a futurist working for Shell, was developing a set of scenarios about the future, and one of the scenarios that they put together and eventually put in place and recommended recommended that Shell act on with the assumption that this would be, in fact be the future, was one in which the Soviet Union was about to founder. And Shell should be taking advantage of, I can't remember what it was, like North Sea drilling or something like that. I mean,
they weren't
even trying to predict geopolitics. They were trying to figure out what would be the best move for Shell Oil to make in terms of economics. And because they could see that the Soviet Union was about to fail, it turned out that certain things made sense and certain other things would not have been as good an opportunity. I think what it turned out to be was it wouldn't make sense to go drilling for natural gas in the North Sea, because once the Soviet Union fell, all the Russian natural gas reserves would open up to the West.
Right, right. I might add now it'd be that I think the situation's changed. There's a lot greater natural gas demand. So.
Oh sure. Well, you know, this would have been probably 25 years ago when they were making those predictions. And I'm sure they're, you know, saying to do other things now. But they were the group who saw the Soviet Union fall. And what's interesting is they weren't necessarily looking for that. So maybe the lesson here is that the future is something you can see better if you're not looking straight at it. I don't know if that.
I think there are a couple of things there that. The first one is that they polled everybody when they got it right. I mean, that's kind of a joke, but that's the when you're predicting the future, you only remind people when you get it right.
Oh, absolutely. We find that to be true. Right.
Well, that's how I work it for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
But a second thing I think is the scenario building, I think, is a very helpful tool. Sometimes you just build crazy scenarios that turn out to be just completely wrong. But the idea is that if you can sort of cover the possible spaces with stories, I guess. You know, stories are a good way to think about what's going to happen. As long as you don't make it too elaborate, you know, and have all sorts of special, strange conditions, that can be a useful way to think about what's going to happen, even if it doesn't work out.
Right, and in fact, I think one of the ideas that Peter Schwartz has advanced is that the role of the futurist less, although they built the reputation on making an accurate prediction, but less of someone who's predicting what's going to happen, and more someone who's creating these kind of broad pictures that are inclusive of what may happen. So they'll write, they'll end up writing two or three scenarios to cover a particular field, to cover a particular topic within the future. And you look at those three scenarios and you say, well, yeah, the future is very likely to fall into there. One way or another, you know, it might not be completely this one or completely that one, but broadly speaking, it looks more likely that the future will, that is to say, we think we can say something now about the future rather than being able to say nothing at all.
Right. Along those lines is also the idea of conditional probability. If event X happens, then you can say what happens in that situation. You have this condition, then you can build scenarios around that. Like the classic ones I hear from you guys all the time are, if the singularity happens, you know, we will have flying cars, immortality. You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that becomes much more likely if, you know, a singularity event happens.
Right. So you look at these, and that's kind of the big one, right? I mean, that's kind of the all or nothing conditional one. But you see a lot of those kinds of things where so people will say, well, if President Bush decides to move on Iran, then blah blah blah, right? Then the future is going to take on this kind of a, and the probabilities around what's going to happen in, say, Israel next year, you know, skew widely depending on whether that trigger gets flipped, right? Or
right.
Yeah, okay, whether anything. Yeah, that's an excellent point. But then to swing it back around to the singularity, and I think this goes to the question that you originally wanted to bring up, Stephen. At what point does the whole idea of predicting or even writing a scenario or even having a well-formed question about what the future is going to be break down? Do we reach a point where we just can't say anything at all about the future?
Well, I think this the singularity is that point. You know, I mean, who can say what the world will be like when people that are smarter than us are running the show? And I mean, that's basically what you're talking about with the singularity, whether it's us augmented or if it's computers or whatever. When beings that are smarter than us are come into existence and really start pushing the future, at that point, I mean, we really don't have much we can say about where things would go. We just don't. It'd be hard for it'd be hard for animals. It's hard for animals to predict what we do and to understand
what
we do, and therefore it would be hard for us to understand what those people would do.
And in fact, it's fair to say animals really can't predict what we're going to do because they fundamentally just don't understand what we're doing, right?
Well, even so, they can often predict well enough, you know, for their own purposes. Like if you're a bear wandering around the woods and you see a human, they're not likely to bother you. And, you know, for the limited thing that a bear cares about, is it going to take my food? Is it going to, you know, challenge me? Humans not going to do that, unless it's really dumb.
Well, that's true.
Well, and in fact, to a certain extent, they really. When I think about my dogs, if I'm sitting at my desk and I close the drawer that holds my keyboard, they know, you know, this is just Pavlovian stuff here, but they know as soon as I've made that move, I'm not using the keyboard anymore, I'm going to get up, and it's entirely possible that I'll go downstairs and let them outside. And so just this act of me closing the drawer, and suddenly they're very excited, right? Or they actually, and this one gets into one of those little, maybe they have a better sense of hearing than we do or something like that, but the littler dog will actually go to the door and be very excited before the garage door starts to open when my wife comes home. It's like, I don't know, he can hear the car coming down the street or something like that, but
I would wager, though, that your dogs have no idea what you're doing on the computer. They may be pretty smart, and they may have great hearing, but They don't have a clue.
That's the singularity right there. Yeah.
And there's the singularity from an animal's point of view.
Yeah. Even if I could, even when I'm writing about them on the blog, that just doesn't mean anything to them. You know, it's like the idea of something being about them doesn't mean anything to them. So, yeah, that's actually a pretty good way of putting it. So they can't predict what I'm going to write because they just don't have any concept of that. And if you can posit intelligences as much smarter than we are, as we are than my Shih Tzus, then we'd be in the same position, right? So we might be able to broadly predict a few things that they're going to do and just luck into getting some of that stuff right. But fundamentally, we wouldn't know what's going on inside their heads because we're just not wired to be able to understand that. And I think
hopefully they will be us. That's my hope. But anyway.
Well, but let's go with that for a minute, though. Are they really still us if they're? I mean, explain that.
Well, I mean,
they're us in what sense?
Yeah, well, I mean that that the beings that I'm talking about that are smarter than humans are today are humans. That
okay.
Humans are augmented. That we're actually. We give ourselves a boost mentally, and by one means or another.
And when you say us, you mean you would also be one of them?
Well, if I live to see it, and that's
an excellent
way. That's the hope, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just thinking about that. Another way to put that is just that we have an upgrade path, you know, to continue participating, you know, at this high level. That would be another. I guess another way to say that.
Okay, so we have the upgrade path, but you still have this possible scenario where, you know, say, Carl, you run ahead and you've had all the upgrades done, and I haven't yet. Okay,
right,
you guys both
right.
do, right? And so we're trying to do a radio show now, and you guys are just so far, right? You start talking about stuff that I just no clue, right? I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, it seems to me that the fundamental distinction can still occur even if they are us, right? Because then you guys could start thinking, well, Phil just doesn't get it, and here we're going to sort the world out on his behalf because he hasn't taken the steps yet and made the upgrade. So from the standpoint of actually, that's very unlikely because if you guys are doing it, you know, what's stopping me? I would probably go ahead and do it too. But
hey, can I give an example of something that none of us will understand?
please.
A group of scientists at Oxford have shown mathematically, or they believe that they have shown mathematically that the parallel universes theory is correct. And let's see if I can get to that. And let me see here.
I saw that a couple weeks ago. I don't know if we linked that at all. We should have, but
we haven't. And I'm sorry, Carl. I'm taking going. In
oh, no problem at all.
But I mean, it kind of has to do with what we were talking about anyway. You guys are familiar, of course, with how in quantum mechanics at the subatomic scale, things. You know, are just remain probabilities until they're observed. Apparently, that appears to be what happens. And then, so, is it a wave or is it a particle? You know, it's a probability. Or what's the position that's spinning in? You know, it can be any and all until it's observed, and then it settles down and decides what it's going to be.
Right.
Well,
we collapse the wave when we observe.
That's
it.
Right. That's
yeah.
exactly
right.
Right. That's right. It's called collapsing the wave function.
Right.
And so basically. You know, mathematics so far beyond what I, you know, I suppose if I spent my life looking at it, maybe I could figure it out. Maybe not. But apparently, these guys at Oxford University have published a paper showing that the parallel universes theory must be correct based on this mathematics, and that every single second the universe is branching off into thousands of different parallel universes based on probabilities. So I guess in some sense, Phil, any prediction that I make is going to be correct in some universe somewhere. So and so you know I can say with you know, whatever I say, no matter how ludicrous or bizarre, it's probably going to be true somewhere in some universe, but maybe not in my own. So maybe
that,
I should still be careful.
That is the that reminds me of something. I just have to tell this story. Last week I was working at this conference in Orlando, and I was part of my job has to do with managing the booth on the trade show floor for the company I work for. And we were raffling off a LCD high def TV. It was a prize we were giving to people who would complete our survey. And we were also handing out other little prizes too. We had these little books, and we ran out of little books, and then we started. We went to Sam's Club and got some candy bars, just so there'd be like some incentive, so that people would fill out these surveys. And this one lady comes to the booth. And she says, "I'd like a candy bar." And I said, "Okay, all I need to do is scan your badge and get you to complete our survey." And she says, "Well, I'm not going to complete write out a whole survey just for a candy bar." And I said, "Oh, yeah, but you're also then in the running for the TV." See, this is my my little backup thing I could say if somebody thought that the first motivation wasn't good enough. This is what marketing geniuses come up with, is this kind of strategy. Okay. And she goes, "Well, yeah, but what's the probability of that? I want to guarantee that I'm going to win." And I said, "Well, are you familiar with the many worlds hypothesis of quantum mechanics?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, just take it from me that according to that, you definitely will win."
Yeah,
"And so will you, sir, and so will you."
This universe.
Yeah, and I just, everyone there, it's guaranteed you'll all win. And they're all like, "Well, wait, how can you say that? We're all going to get the TV." I'm like, "Well, not in this universe, though. That's the, you know."
I love that.
That's the only drawback. So,
yeah.
But you know what the important thing is? She completed the survey. I think that's the main.
Well,
at least in this universe, she did. So.
And in some universe, she's happy she did. She got the TV.
Well, she got her candy bar anyway. Yeah, I mean, she did get it somewhere. So.
Yeah. At any rate, I guess I should always buy a lottery ticket just to benefit some Steven somewhere, huh? yeah, I'm certainly, you know, the chances of it being the universe in which who knows?
Nothing. Well, it's what's interesting is I guess if you buy a ticket, you create the world in which you win it, right? I mean, you can't win it unless you buy the ticket, unless some other version of you is already buying. I don't know. It starts to get a little bit more than a little confusing at that point. But that also brings up the similar topic of quantum immortality. And I don't know if we've ever talked about quantum immortality on the show.
I think it got brought up, but it was maybe on the second or third show, Phil. So explain it again.
Oh, well, basic idea here is, again, using the many worlds hypothesis as our starting point, is that in any...
They live forever somewhere, right?
Yeah, exactly. In any scenario where you could die or not die, it's going to branch one, you know, with some probability, some worlds where you'll die and some worlds where you won't die. And the point is you'll continue branching off in worlds where you live. They'll become fewer and fewer, and it becomes less and less likely, but you're never fully eliminated. So you ultimately live forever because the possibility of your dying is never realized in certain in certain quantum branching. So you achieve this quantum immortality. Now the question is,
what about Abraham Lincoln or somebody lived, you know, obviously a long time ago? They would be so far beyond human lifespan that it would seem that their chances of living to this time would be essentially zero, right?
Well, I guess one of the big arguments against quantum immortality, it seems to me, should be that there ought to be this like one really freakishly old person somewhere on this planet, right? And and he would be the guy who's like following that branch for him, right? All the way out.
Well, maybe there is, and he's keeping it a secret. You ever heard of the Wandering Jew?
Right, or it's like Highlander, maybe. You know?
Oh yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Actually, my take on that is that you're basically taking one of a, I mean, there's a host of them where early, and so you're looking for these really rare ones where, you know, somebody lives a ridiculously long period of time.
Right.
And the thing is why would we expect to live in that freakish occurrence rather than all the ones where they don't live, particularly long time?
Well, that's a really good point. And actually, in most worlds, you wouldn't have anybody who had made it to that far, would you?
Yeah.
So actually, the fact that there isn't anyone like that sort of helps prove that quantum immortality is real, right?
The exception proves the rule.
I might be pushing that evidence a little further than it will actually take us, but that's a good point, Carl. We wouldn't expect to be living necessarily in a world where that had branched with someone way out there, because the way out there worlds, there are going to be a lot fewer of those, but they are out there. And the question is, where is your consciousness, and is your consciousness, is it following you through all these branchings? And I guess the question I'm having a hard time articulating here is, would each of us on this call, excuse me, on this radio show, or everyone listening in, according to quantum immortality, would we all then have the experience subjectively of living forever? Is that where quantum immortality takes us? I think maybe that must be where it takes us.
Well, I think not, though, Phil. I think that we all will experience death in many universes, and maybe just and live on if you buy this theory. In one, so I mean, we experience death a lot more often than we experience life, and that's kind of the joke of the lottery ticket again. I buy the lottery ticket to benefit some Stephen somewhere else, but it sure doesn't benefit me here.
Right.
You know, and the Stephen that lives forever in some branch in some really strange branched off the universe, that doesn't necessarily help me if I'm in a universe where I don't live forever. So.
I follow that, and yet I feel like I've misrepresented quantum immortality, because it seems to me that the actual argument is, and if anyone else is listening in, or if Carl, if you have any thoughts on this, our caller who is on the line, I think the idea is that somehow, subjectively, everybody does get to live forever under quantum immortality. I might be overstating it.
Well, the thing that, now going back to the mini-universe theory, one of the things I don't know if they have figured it out or not, but it's a question, do these universes interact with one another? Like, say, I buy the lottery ticket, somebody benefits from me buying the lottery ticket, can he somehow help me back again? You know, build some fancy machine and, you know, send a few bucks through or something.
Can you spare a dime?
Yeah, pretty much. And
yeah.
I hate to say it, but it looks like these things are independent to me. You know,
meaning?
That once it splits off, I never see that anymore.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you carry
the lottery winner, he's gone I'm cut off from him forever.
Right, you're cut off from him, but you consciously... Okay, here it is. I've gone to the ultimate source of all authority of knowledge, okay, Wikipedia. So now we can bask in the authoritative explanation that I'm about to provide here. Okay.
Hey, a commenter just said this is why they wouldn't recommend signing up for the quantum suicide experiment.
Commenter, you should call in. Okay, but this is exactly what I was just about to read was a retelling of the quantum suicide experiment. Okay, a physicist sits in front of a gun, which is triggered or not triggered, depending on the decay of some radioactive atom. So it's like Schrodinger's cat all over again. Okay. Only this time it's the guy himself. With each run of the experiment, there's a 50-50 chance that the gun will be triggered and the physicist will die. If the Copenhagen interpretation is correct, then the gun will eventually be triggered and the physicist will die. If the many-worlds interpretation is correct, then in each run of the experiment, the physicist will be split into one world in which he lives and another world in which he dies. Okay, so far this is exactly what we've been talking about. After many runs of the experiment, there will be many worlds. In the worlds where the physicist dies, he will cease to exist. However, from the point of view of the non-dead copies of the physicist, the experiment will continue running without his ceasing to exist, because at each branch, he will only be able to observe the result in the world in which he survives. And if Many Worlds is correct, the surviving copies of the physicist will notice that he never seems to die, therefore proving himself to be immortal, at least from his own point of view. Okay, so that's the clincher. Some physicists are dying along the way. In fact, more are dying than are living. But if,
a whole lot more, yeah.
Yeah, but if you're the immortal one, in the end, there can be only one, I guess. what we end up with.
There was a great movie, and the name escapes me, that it involved Tesla and these magicians and all this. Can you guys help me out with the name of that?
The Prestige. It was called The Prestige.
Ah, yes. Watch it. I won't say anything more because I don't want to ruin it for anybody that's listening. Just watch it. You'll understand why I brought it up.
There is an odd connection between what we're talking about here. Without spoiling the movie, there is an odd connection between what we're talking about here and what happens in that movie. I would agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so where to next, Stephen?
Okay. Well, let me see. Carl, have you been following a sports team lately? We started off talking sports.
I'm afraid not. No, I don't keep up with that stuff.
Okay. Well, you know. Anyway,
we do only from a scientific standpoint because it's important. Teaches us about
probability. You talk about Arizona. I'm definitely not an Arizona fan. So
good man. Now you're talking. Good. Okay.
Well, how is your team doing, Phil? I know you still got it on the tube there.
It is the top of the ninth, and Arizona's at bat. Obviously, they got no outs right now. I don't know who's up, but he's got two strikes. So potentially we're, seven strikes away from wrapping this game up here. Don't worry, I will announce with great enthusiasm
when it happens.
If and when Colorado wins this game. Not counting on anything yet. But actually, where I thought you were going to take us next, Stephen, was kind of.
I've regained my train of thought.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
We're back on track. So anyway, I wanted to bring all this into line with your amazing exponential speech, Phil, that you gave a couple of years back. You were trying to explain to people that may not have been, singularity aware, how exponential thinking works and why we believe that, the future is, that truly bizarre and wild futures may be closer than a lot of people realize. And a lot of it's exponential development of technology. Okay. Moore's law is just part of it. But, if you get computers that are increasing in power, if they're doubling in power every 12 months or 18 months, whatever it is now, then you can't look at this in a linear fashion. You have to think of technological development exponentially. And what I wanted to kind of bring up is that even those of us who kind of get that, we still can get things so wrong. If you start talking about time frames, any further out than say 10 or 15 years, because it's even more complicated than that.
Right.
And the reason, the reason it's more complicated than that is that we're dealing with more than one chessboard. We got the chessboard of computation that's pushing everything in the world, but you also, but that spawned another chessboard of biotech and quantum computers. And all these different areas that can feed back to even computation, or they all feed upon one another and they interact in ways that we can't quite, no one, no matter how smart they are, can quite predict how these things are going to interact with one another and bring the future about. So, as I was saying early in the show, we can predict fairly confidently what the world will be like in the near future. Next year, there'll be some neat stuff, but we probably won't be jetpacking to the office.
Right.
But the world gets kind of weird 10 years, 15 years, 20 years out, And, you know, we believe we've got a handle on some things, but we may not even the most basic things, we may not really be predicting it right. So I guess that was the point I wanted to make.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. And the distinction between
by the way, I call that Spock's chessboard.
Yeah, the old Spock's chessboard, you know. So it's like you're not just dealing in this two-dimensional playing space. Suddenly you've got three dimensions. You've got different levels of the board. And really there are a lot more factors involved even than that when you're talking about quote unquote the future. When you're saying what, you know, the whole world is going to be like next year, because then you've got the chessboard of, you know, popular entertainment and geopolitics and the price of oil and so many different factors playing into things.
Terrorism. Yep.
Well, terrorism, exactly. I mean, we did this. Story, I can't remember how long ago it was. It seems like a couple months back, on how the sushi craze started. And it didn't start because, you know, people in North America or people in Europe said, wow, I'd really like to start eating raw Japanese fish. That just sounds really appealing to me, and I think I need to start doing that, right? It was this interesting situation where a Japanese airline needed to fill its cargo crates on the return trips to North America. What are they going to put in? They start putting fish in, and they created a market for something that hadn't existed before. If you don't have a guy looking to fill cargo holds on aircraft, would there be a sushi craze in this country? It's really hard to say, and it's entirely possible that that there in fact would not.
Phil, we got another caller.
Oh.
Carl, hang on. This is not going to bump you off, okay? But I'm going to put you on hold. But you can still hear.
We're going to go free for all here.
Yeah.
But, you know, before you introduce the caller, I just want to say the Rockies have won. That's three games straight. If they win one more, they will have swept the Arizona Diamondbacks and won the pennant. Thank you very much.
Well, congratulations to your team.
And woohoo! By the way,
woohoo! Yeah. we got a caller from the area code 412. Where are you calling from?
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh.
I'm not doing Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
What's your name, caller?
Matt Doing.
Matt?
Yeah.
Welcome to the program, Matt. Welcome. We're pleased to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm a long-time reader of your blog. Going back to that quantum suicide comment I made, are you familiar with the Overcoming Bias blog?
Sure, yeah. Frequent reader of that blog, as a matter of fact.
That subject came up on there once, and a commenter said that following the logic where your consciousness is maintained through the different world lines, that somewhere there should be a version of you that can never fall asleep.
That seems as logical as anything else. yeah, I can see that.
That's amazing. That pretty much answers it, doesn't it? When you because suddenly I start thinking of all kinds of other like wacky things, right? There's a version of you that never hits a red light ever.
Uh-huh.
Right? You always get a green light, right? Always wins on roulette.
Every girl I ever asked out that said no.
Yeah, thanks for getting it to the real stuff there, Stephen.
Yeah, there you go.
I wasn't able to make that leap. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. There's some universe out there where she said yes. So, well, in this universe, I got the right one. So there.
Oh, well, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, could I just comment briefly on that? Having met your lovely and charming wife, I'd say we live in quite an outlier universe anyway.
Soraya, I mean,
based on that,
how in the world did you ever do so good, Phil?
Well, there you go. It's an outlier universe. That's what I'm telling you.
That's great.
Very strange universe.
I've also heard a posting from a physicist that said a possible application of strong AI would be to run an experiment where the AI can exactly duplicate its movements at different times and could possibly reconverge two of the world lines and could possibly test it that way.
So what would that mean? If you reconverged the world lines, you would have a world in which a thing both happened and did not happen, and the inhabitants of that world would have memories of both those events. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, that I
think I saw a science fiction show that that had that as a plot point at some point. I forget how that worked out. Anyway.
Yeah.
Well,
that's pretty bizarre, though.
Well, depending on the event, if we're talking about quantum immortality, then you got a world where a guy died and didn't die, right? I mean, that's the. What does he remember, right?
Well, that would certainly come as a shock to everybody that was at his funeral when they see him walk through the door. You're right.
I'll have to try and find that. I think it was on Arbic. I should email it to you sometime.
Yeah, please do. Please do. I'd like to see that, Matt.
One thing to take into account is that that could happen, but could we see that? The very act of observing it might cause it to collapse into a sensible configuration that makes sense to us. So it could happen. Your AI could be in this mixed state, you know, thinking and so on. But when we look at it, it's just in one state. The experiment must have failed. We don't see the full thing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And we end up in some side universe, you know. Then.
Yeah, that seems more likely to me because it seems like the coin is always going to be either heads or tails, right? It seems that the way this is set up is that you always get one outcome or you get a different outcome. You don't get two outcomes at the same time.
Well, let me just ask you guys. I mean, we got a bunch of smart guys on here. How does quantum computing figure into all this, multi-universes and all this, parallel universes? I mean, the way they seem to operate is almost as if they're borrowing computation from other parallel universes. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's the way to think of it, actually, if I understand quantum computing. It's not like a classical computer. It's always in sort of in a fixed state.
It's definitely in this universe.
Right, yeah. Right. It's definitely in this universe. As I understand it, with a quantum computer, it's in a mixed state. It doesn't, by its nature, it can't interact with the outside universe or you break it. Because it turns out even if you're not looking at what's going on inside, and your observation would break it, because we're classical observers, if you will. But any observation from the outside universe apparently can mess it up. That's my understanding, anyway. So they have to isolate it pretty well to get it to do anything. And apparently they've got a few that can do stuff. Like the top thing I've heard about is factoring 15. Into 3 and 5. That's been done in a quantum computer. Not very exciting, but it is something.
It actually works, and so given enough time to develop it, it'll be able to outdo any other classical computer that you can put next to it, with some problems.
Yeah. Why did we need mathematicians to prove mathematically that the many worlds hypothesis exists when we have functioning quantum computers that have apparently demonstrated it by the fact that they're able to perform these calculations? Doesn't the fact that a quantum computer works demonstrate that the whole principle of parallel universes, or am I missing something there?
Well, I think the thing that's missing is how do you formulate multiple universe, this infinite universe situation. Just because you have something, that looks suspiciously like there's, multiple universes, how do you actually express that? So, there's a various, in the fundamental physics, they're still having trouble coming up with. Well, they definitely do not have a theory that mixes quantum mechanics and gravity yet.
for example. And I'm getting way off topic here. But the idea is that there's still a lot of physical problems that we just don't have a good mathematical description for.
Right.
And I think this was one of them. Didn't have a good description of an infinite number of universes and how what happens when we, observe in such a situation.
I wonder if the unified theory is waiting for someone who really understands the parallel universes well enough to be able to, join the theories of the very small with the theories of the very big. And I wonder if there's some secret lying there that waiting for some genius to fully understand it. I just wonder if that somehow would play into it.
Well, Stephen, the many worlds hypothesis insists that somewhere you are that guy.
It's just a shame it's not in this universe. I spent too much time playing in college.
You have done the work and made that happen for us.
In some universe somewhere, huh?
Well, listen, I'd like to thank both of our callers for making this such a fun show for us this evening. It's great talking with both you guys. We hope that you will both take the time to listen again and to call in again.
Sure.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. We're gonna I know Carl. I think you were having trouble hearing. Otherwise, I'm just gonna you can continue to listen in on your phone. It's not gonna be a problem. Okay.
Sure.
All right. Well, that was a fun discussion, Phil. I mean, do we have time to talk about at least one more thing?
Yeah, if you want to bring one more topic. This has been kind of our grab bag show because we didn't have a guest, although we ended up with a couple of great guests in the form of our callers. But we've hit some fun topics, and I think maybe you have one more that you'd like to throw out there before we go. Because you know what, I have one little housekeeping thing I want to work on before the very end of the show, but I'll let you bring up your final topic first.
Well, the twin suns, and this was something you blogged about. This was and it was actually a couple of weeks ago, I think. In this article that you were pointing to, Phil, there's this other. I mean, it's another star, very much like our own sun, in size and energy output. It's a yellow star. So it's going to obviously be an object of much study, and search for extraterrestrial intelligence. We'll probably want to take a look and see if there are any rocky worlds, as we're able to point, see Earth-sized planets. That will definitely be one that will be checked out closely, and it's not all that far away, is it?
Absolutely not. I'm trying to find the blog post here so I can put the facts behind it. But it's not terribly far away. And the other thing that was interesting about that was apparently there are a number of these stars out there that have a signature that is fairly similar to our sun.
200 light years. I'm looking here at the article here. 200 light years from here.
Okay. So what's interesting about that is. At 200 light years out, let's just say that this very Earth-like sun has a very Earth-like planet orbiting it and a very human-like species living on it. They have not yet been subjected to our I Love Lucy reruns, right?
No.
Because we've only hit about 50 light years out in all directions with that kind of stuff. So theoretically, they don't know about us. But we ought to know about them, if we can point.
Why is that, Phil? I know where you're going with this, but why is that?
Okay, because if they're there, chances are they're we've only had technological civilization for a few years, so you would assume that a technological civilization would be farther along than we are, just by virtue of the fact that we're very early into it. Therefore, they would be emitting radio broadcasts for, statistically, you would figure a much longer period of time, much longer than 50 years, much longer than 200 years. And so their footprint of radio waves should already be reaching us. We should be able to point a radio telescope at that star and we should get something back. I mean, it might not be I Love Lucy reruns. It might be something that would be, you know, far beyond our ability to comprehend what it is, but there ought to be something clearly artificial coming from that direction that would say to us, aha, yes, there is a civilization living on that planet. And that's why both this star and these 17,000 other very sun-like stars that SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has identified, these are all great targets for looking for intelligent life. They should all be, or any of them that have what I described, a human-like civilization living there, should be emitting some kind of signal. There should be some kind of signature that lets us know, aha, there they are.
Well, we got a commenter that says that they might not be emitting radio waves anymore.
Well, I was going to go there. In fact, that's the that's
we have
that's
some good
drawback.
we're having a good text chat going on.
Yeah, we do. The problem with that argument is just like we don't really much watch TV over broadcast anymore, and it's just been 50 years since I Love Lucy. The chances that they would still be using radio as a principal means of communication, or for anything at all, say 1,000 years into the process, are hard to estimate. I mean, this is one of those the future is hard to predict things. Maybe there'd be an application for radio, but it's just as likely to say, well, maybe they use something completely different that we have no idea how it is, what it is, and therefore we have no idea how to try to detect it. So
some sort of subspace thing, or who knows?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Something we haven't even invented yet.
Yeah, some. I mean, this could take us back to the transparent aluminum discussion that I don't think we want to get back into. But
no,
yeah.
I don't think we want to go there. So, not with 3 minutes to go in our show. Actually, let's wrap this up. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say some technological leap that we haven't made. So that makes what the SETI folks are trying to do very challenging. But it makes it a lot easier, at least if they're looking at sun-like stars. It does seem to increase the chances that maybe they'll find an Earth-like planet out there. I certainly wish them the best of luck on that.
Absolutely, and they got to narrow it down because there's a lot to look at out there, and you want to stack the odds in your favor as much as you can with something like that.
Well, as much as you can, but then when a civilization is found, it might be in some completely weird situation. It might be living on a brown dwarf or circling a big binary star. It might be in the midst of radiation that would be lethal to us. I mean, there
might be some sort of gas intelligence on a gas giant planet. We don't, who knows? The universe is probably weirder than we can imagine.
Right. Absolutely. Well, it's bound to be. So my housekeeping note, I wanted to say, I think this is our 18th edition. I'm going to stop saying episode. I've been criticized for our misuse of the word episode. We got a little bit of commentary on that from remember James Bennett when he was on the show on his blog. He didn't say anything directly. He put the word episode in quotes on the latest episode of Fast Forward Radio. That's what they call it. Technically these aren't episodes because, it's not like Jack Bauer gets into a new scrape each week or something like that. So we'll stop using the word episode. And
we're live. We might get into scrapes. Give us
I feel like we come near a scrape just about every time since we've been live.
Yeah.
But it's actually been a bit more episodic. So we'll probably stop. We'll probably stop numbering them is actually what I was going to say. Just in the way that, we don't know if this is the 26,000th David Letterman show since he does one every night. Since we're doing one every week now, we're probably just going to go to putting the date on it and saying this will be the show for a particular
week,
date.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And we want to go ahead and let everybody know that, next week, same time, tune in.
We're going to stop numbering them because there's going to be more than you can count anyway. So.
Oh yeah, we hope. Anyway, and this has been a whole lot of fun, and I love doing these live shows a lot more than the way we did it before. So
great fun, and thanks again to our callers. What a treat to have both of them on the show with us tonight.
Yeah, call again, callers. Y'all are great. Okay, let's go ahead and finish this up. All our music, both the the bumper at the very beginning of the show and the song I'm about to play. You can find it all at magnatune.com. And, of course, our blog is The Speculist, S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. And come by there as well.
All right. And we will listen to the music on the way out. Look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
Good night.
That was track number 9 from the album File and Rhythm by Bates from Magnatune.com.
Most Tuesdays are just Tuesdays, except at Buffalo Wild Wings, where Tuesdays are Wing Tuesdays. But now even Wing Tuesdays aren't just Wing Tuesdays, because Wing Tuesdays are half-price Wing Tuesdays, which means your boring Tuesday that became Wing Tuesday now costs you half as much. In case you're confused, we have half-price Wing Tuesdays. We do it for you. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Prices and participation vary. See participating locations for details. Void where prohibited.